Hi everyone, and welcome to Keyframe, the Geek Show's dedicated animation podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today is Tucky.
Hello!
And we're on our own again, Tucky.
Well, is it lonely when there's two of us?
No. I'm never lonely when I'm with you. You know this.
Ah, yes, soft shit.
Anyway, we're diving straight in because we've got an interesting topic. Now, Mark, who's from this parish, he actually pointed us in the direction of an article about the problem with UK anime conventions, which basically the article was stating that UK anime conventions could become better. And it got me interested because you run a convention in the north of England. In fact, you're going to be running two this year. I've covered a lot of conventions. We've both attended a hell of a lot of conventions. And so it got me thinking, well, yeah, I read the article. There were some valid points, but there were also some points that weren't as valid, I felt, because a lot of the article focused on the south of England. One of the blatant things that were missed on the article was MCM.
Yeah, this is the thing, like MCM is the powerhouse of anime conventions.
Yeah.
Well, not anime conventions as such, just multi-diverse, how do they do it? Multiple media.
Multimedia, kind of, It's a big multimedia trade show, I'd say, more than anything else. It's more like a trade show. MCM.
All right. It's an exposition in ways and a lot of clout behind it, financially. I mean, they're run by Reed Pop, who do the big New York Comic Cons, and I think they've got some foothold, a huge foothold in America.
Oh, yeah. But this is the thing. When you're talking about other conventions like Minamicon, Amicon, Tokunatsu, Kitacon, obviously SonyCon in Newcastle.
And Liverpool.
Scotland Loves Anime.
Well, Scotland Loves Anime is more of a film festival than an actual convention. Yeah.
There's, I think, where things deviate. Because I agreed with one part of the article in particular. UK conventions are lacking something.
Oh, yeah.
What that something is debatable, and I know that when you're writing an opinion piece like that article was, you look at it from your own particular perspective. But I think this is one of those topics where it's open for debate, and only by talking to people who actually run conventions can you start pinpointing where potential problems are, where potential areas of improvement are. One of the things that I want to get off my chest with regards to UK conventions, UK anime conventions in particular, is that, and with the best will in the world, they're all the same. If you go to one, you've been to them all. They will literally all be the same. You will have a trader's floor, you will have an artist's alley, you may or may not have some voice actors in attendance, and you'll generally have some panels. And that's the basic format of it.
Yeah, the blueprint's pretty much the same. I can see SonyCon's like that as well. Every convention I've been to, some occasionally throw culture into the mix. Live performances, the parties as well for 18-plus attendees.
Yeah. Kita, for example, was the party con. Hyper Japan does a lot of things that are very interesting. I mean, there's the food side of things, there's the culture side of things. They get a lot of singers and bands from Japan who perform over the course of the event as well.
They've got an amazing network with on the culture and on the business side, the Japanese business side. It has fallen from grace in recent years.
Yeah,
that's none of my business. It's just taking on what fans are saying, what traders are saying. And I can see from Hyper Japan's point of view, because they used to be at Earl's Court, which huge, monumental venue in Britain. They've had to downgrade time and time again. And they had the blueprint, they had the foundation for this huge event. and then having to like filter it down into a smaller venue, but try and keep it the same size has been an issue for them, from what I understand.
Yeah. And that, again, is a valid issue. And they've been trying and trying and trying. That's fine. I just want to put Hyper Japan off on just off in its own corner for a moment. And I'm going to do the same with MCM, just off in its own corner for the moment, right? The rest of them, right? And this is the thing. I think that right now in the UK and across the UK, I think that the market for conventions is far too saturated because of you have this template format of traders, artists, panels, and maybe a voice actor or two, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got that format and that blueprint, it's become far too easy for people to try and run a convention. And that then makes it not special, whereas at one time it was. I mean, I remember the first time I went to Ame and Minoi, which was long before conventions became like a big thing across mm-hmm. the UK. And it was a really special occasion where I could go and meet people who had the same interests as me, who liked the same shows that I did, who'd read the same manga that I'd read. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas now, there's not really that much special, unless you're into cosplay. There's not really much that separates one convention from another. The venue, I think, plays a big part, right?
Even that's becoming saturated.
But even that's becoming saturated, as you said. But I think with regards to the actual content, I think that in general, you know, and I'm not tarring all conventions with the same brush because each convention has its own merits, has its own plus points. But I think in general, UK conventions are boring.
Oh.
That's not to say all of them are, but in general, I think as a generalization, I mean, you can pick out the odd convention here and there. I've been going to SunnyCon for, ever since you set up SunnyCon. Right. Mm-hmm. And in general, I am not bored when I go to SunnyCon because I've been there year on year. I know a lot of the people who are there as traders, as artists, and as attendees. And so there are people who I know, there are people who I haven't seen for a while who I will happily sit down and chat with. There is impetus for me to go to SunnyCon and to continue going to SunnyCon. But if you take into account all of the other much smaller conventions, I have no interest in going to them.
Yeah, no, I can say that. I mean, I go to conventions half for market research, half just for fun. It's a different experience. It's a weird thing because, like, most con organisers, they'll sit in the house, like, most days of the year and, you know, just, I don't know. I don't know what most other con organisers do. The ones that I've met are always, like, shy, bashful, kind of in their own world. And trying to network or break down them barriers, I think that's only really Phil. Probably it's the guys who run Rycon as well.
Yeah. Is Rycon the Irish one?
No, it's in Glasgow.
That one, yeah.
Them are really the only ones who I can really just like crack on with. EJ down in Cambridge as well.
Yeah.
They're the kind of people. Well, that's like because of a close like friendship, and they, you know, I made friends with them over SunnyCon. I've known Phil through the show and whatnot, and it's kind of a weird thing for me because I was down at AmiCon last year, and I got to meet the organizer of Ami, and it was kind of weird because they're all sitting having their conversation. There's me and Donna just kind of like within earshot of them. It kind of looks like we're spying on them in a way, but we're just like sitting trying to have a hot chocolate and that, and. You know, I go over and say hi. You know, I'm Tucky from SunnyCon, and you know, this is Donna, and you know, we're enjoying your event. Or do we just leave them to be and just natter in the own group? Because it's a like I say from my point of view as another con organizer, it's like, do they see us as rivals and threats, or do they actually just see us as just like people like them who can empathise with them with their struggles? But I haven't broken that barrier yet. Something I hope to do so in the future. But as you're saying, oversaturated market, oversaturated industry, that's something that's brought well into light in recent times. As I believe July 21st this year, in Newcastle, we found out that there's a I don't know what they call it, a sci-fi con or just a general like non-anime convention. They're running in our venue a month after us. There's another Anime League event which is running on the same day in a hotel down the road. Woodhorn, which is a well-established sci-fi event, is having their 10th year anniversary on the same day, just up the road from there as well. And Pride weekend is on as well. So Newcastle on July 21st is going to be this hotbed of different like gigs trying to like vying for, you know, to go to different events. And it's such a mess.
Yeah.
Like the calendars became such a mess. Like say back in the old days, you could plan an event and you were pretty much certain you could pick any week that no other event was running on and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, you've got your slot. And as times went on now, I think SunnyCon's clashing with like two or three events in June, August, we're clashing with events as well. And it's became hyper-competitive. And smaller events run by fans and whatnot, they'll appeal to the locals, but, you know, it's taking kind of like money from bigger events to the smaller ones, but the small ones might just go bust. And the issue I have with like smaller, more unorganized events is they seem to be rashly done. Like you say, there's that blueprint of, oh, well, I need a venue, traders hall and some panels. And, you know, that's a convention.
Yeah.
And it's more complex than that. There's a lot of planning. There's a lot of market research. It took me 2 years before I dared start up SunnyCon.
Yeah.
And nothing. And I did that from the perspective of I was a trader at events. I attended events. I spoke to other convention organizers, both in the local area and across the nation. And I did a lot of thorough research. I had a business plan drawn up. Whereas these days it's like, oh, I've hired a venue, you know, let's have an event.
Yeah. And that I think is where your first problem lies with UK conventions. Because the majority of UK conventions, and I'm not including the likes of Ame and Kitta and Tokunatsu, the rest of them, the older conventions, the ones that have been going steadily year on year and building year on year, they've got an established format. They've got a model that they use.
It's generated a loyal fan base, which has kept going back year after year,
yeah,
which has sustained them. So it's...
Yeah. Likewise, the likes of MCM have a lot of money that they can throw at things, and the likes of Hyper Japan have a massive network that allows them to bring in things that other conventions simply don't have access to. Where you have this dilution of the market, what you have, and I think this is one of the worst things that can happen for UK conventions, as you said, I've got a hall, got some traders, got some artists, I've got a convention, let's go. But there is a certain degree of unprofessionalism with that, and once that starts seeping in at the grassroots level, because we're talking about grassroots conventions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But once that starts seeping in at the grassroots level, you have this spread of belief that anyone can run a convention anywhere, and then that eventually spreads, and that level, that unprofessionalism basically builds its way up through the food chain. People who've learned at the grassroots level that it's so easy to run a convention, if they become part of the organizing committee of a much bigger convention, they will have a certain lackadaisical attitude, especially as they're volunteers in general. They don't get paid, right? Mm-hmm. But they will have a certain lackadaisical attitude, a certain, how should I say, it'll get done eventually attitude. I've noticed that has been creeping in a lot with the bigger conventions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that stems from all these grassroots conventions, because they come in and they don't have an action plan. They don't have a project mandate or anything like that. They don't have a timeline of how they want things to do. They don't give themselves deadlines. And without that, the bad working habits set in.
It's not just that as well. I mean, smaller conventions can come in. And like you say, it is grassroots. And one of the jobs of a convention, especially for SunnyCon, is we've had to build a community from scratch.
Yeah.
And that's in Sunderland, that's in Newcastle, that's all over the Northeast. We've had to work hard, and nearly 8 years of doing so, we've had people who are like 12-year-old wear their first convention.
Yeah.
And they come in and they see, and experience, and we hope that the experience stays with them. So they'll want to come next year and the year after that and the year after that. And it makes a sustainable customer base.
Yeah.
They will always give us their money as long as we keep them entertained.
Yeah.
And when you look at smaller conventions, one bad experience can turn a potential customer away. And it's doesn't just affect, it's not just like that one small convention that gets hurt. It's every like other convention in the food chain.
Exactly.
It spoils it for us. And
that's what I mean. That's what I mean. You know, that cascade effect I was talking about. From bad working practices, that's where it stems from. What you have to remember, whenever you're running a convention, it could be someone's first convention, especially if you're running a grassroots one, because there are so many people who can't afford to go to a bigger convention. They don't have the money to finance a hotel or just even the ticket for a day. We do live in hard times, after all, and going to a convention is a luxury. It should be something special. And one of the things that I would really love to happen is for convention organizers, maybe not even as a group, but just in general, to start thinking outside of the box, to kind of move away from the standard blueprint that has become the norm, and start stamping their own unique identity onto their own conventions. And make it theirs fully, so that it's something totally unique. So if somebody goes to Ame or Minami, they're two very different experiences. Do you see what I mean?
Well, that's where the issues arise, because like I say, these conventions, they have a sustainable like work ethic and they have a loyal community. And yeah. Most of these events have limited ticket availability as well.
Yeah.
So the amount of new attendees going in is going to be very, very small in comparison.
Yeah, I'm not saying you make sweeping, drastic changes overnight.
No. Like say, it is a thing about identity, and it is that unique selling point that you want your convention to stand out over others. I mean, just look to America, look at the likes of Dragon Con, or Anime Expo in Los Angeles. How they differ from like San Diego Comic Con or New York's.
Anime Expo in LA. They run their AX Live, don't they?
Yeah, they have concerts on. It's a proper 24-hour convention.
Yeah, the thing is. One, we don't have a 24-hour convention because everybody in this country seems to have a bedtime. Number two, I think that one of the limiting factors that we've had, and I've been saying this for a long time, you know I have, Tucky, one of the biggest limiting factors that we've had for a long, long time is our over-reliance on American voice actors. We want them to come over because they're the ones who voice the dubs, but I have never understood. And I still don't, because nobody can explain it to me in a way that I would actually appreciate and would actually make sense to my business mentality. Nobody's ever actually explained it to me properly. If you have an American voice actor, they make certain demands. And you know what their demands would be, Tucky. You run conventions and we've discussed this before. So I'm not going to bother going into what their demands would be. But then you have, on the flip side, a Japanese voice actor, and you've had Fumiko over. From your experience, which was easier to deal with, the Japanese voice actress or the American voice actors and actresses?
Well, it's not so much that's easier to deal with. Like you say, lots of different voice actors, lots of different things.
Yeah, I'm not trying to tar all voice actors with the same brush.
No. There are those voice actors who are easygoing. There are those who can be quite diva-ish.
Yeah. And your first year of running SunnyCon, you had Chris Sabat and Veronica Taylor, and both of them were absolutely adorable, right?
They were fantastic. I mean, the thing is, like, when we started, we were naive, we were kind of big headed in our approach, because we thought, you know, well, we've got voice actors. You know, how many other conventions at the time had voice actors over? Not very many, and the fact that they agreed to come over to Crowtree Leisure Centre of all places in the world, well, like, yeah, we have struck gold here. And doing guest relations, Chris arrived early. I think he had a look around Newcastle before he came through to Sunderland. That was fine. Veronica, she was picked up. She had a daughter with her and everything. Got them to the hotel, just introduced them, gave them a few like bits of info, and they went off and did their own thing. I believe they were studying the cannonball formation of rocks at Roker, which is like one of only two places in the world that have cannonball-shaped rocks, apparently. Mm. And I didn't know that, but Veronica Taylor taught me that. Ash Ketchum taught me about rocks in my hometown.
Yeah.
That was an interesting experience, but go to SunnyCon 2.
Yeah, we don't talk about that, okay? We're not going to go into that because that leads to a whole other can of worms. You know this.
Yeah. All I can say is like 2 out of the 3 guests were amazing.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. We were treated. We were so lucky to have Chris and Veronica in year one.
Yeah.
And that made us cautious going forward. Year 3, J. Michael and Quentin Flynn came over.
Yeah.
They were amazing. Quentin
is amazing. Quentin and I were having a proper heart-to-heart sitting outside, and there's just so many people trying to just eavesdrop on what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And me and Quentin are just having a proper deep discussion, which I'm not going to go into because it was personal. So I'm not going to go into it. Quentin, wherever you are, love you, man. You're amazing.
Yeah, he's up there like as one of the best guests. And the thing is, we don't usually do repeat guests, but Quentin, we anytime he's in the UK, we make an effort to go and see him wherever he is.
Yeah.
Especially with Kingdom Hearts like 3 coming back out, just hearing his voice on the game.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, you know, that's our friend. I've got a personal like signed Kingdom Hearts clock on my cabinet. One of only few because he's got all these weird collectibles, and it's like, oh.
Yeah, he is amazing. But J. Michael Tatum was also amazing.
Oh, my word. His partner, Brandon, were funny.
J. Michael Tatum is one of the most charming men I have met in my life.
He is. He's genuine, and he's got the sexiest French accent I've ever heard from a man.
Oh, God. Don't. Do you know what he kind of reminded me of? A little bit, right? Remember Pepe Le Pew?
Yeah.
I think if he started doing the Pepe Le Pew accent, so many people would literally just swoon for him.
Oh, hello, Sherry.
Ah, oh, ma chérie.
It's not just them guests. Like we've had Michelle Nutz, Jay Carter Cathcart.
Who were brilliant. Jeremy Lee. The interview I did with Jeremy was, you know, she's adorable.
Yep. Oh, she is. And the thing that struck us was how small she was. I'm always surprised to see how small people are.
Yeah. Don't start going to celebrity heights. We'll be here all day.
Caitlin as well,
yeah.
Johnny Young Bosch as well,
yeah.
all amazing guests. And back on topic, I've just name dropped everyone.
Yeah, really. You have. But that brings us down to my point about the voice actors. Okay, I think there is an over reliance, and once you've had a certain number of voice actors on, because there are only so many questions you can ask a voice actor. Let's be fair.
Well, there is, but it's they have things outside of voice acting.
They do have things outside of voice acting. My point is that when you brought Fumiko over, there was a very big difference in Fumiko's experience of voice acting and, say, Veronica Taylor's, right? Yeah. And that has to do with the way the industries work. And one of the reasons why I've always pushed for bringing Japanese voice actors over is to highlight just how very different the industries are, and just the amount of professionalism that is in the Japanese industry. Yes, the voice acting industry in America is professional as well, but I think that it's nowhere near as polished as it is in Japan.
Yeah, it's true. It's different cultures. It is,
yeah.
And what the difference is, because in the UK, like I said, dub actors are easy to get. I think we've actually got an agent based in the UK now who touts for voice actors who do English dubs.
Yeah.
So, you know, UK events, you don't have to go to, like, these daft American agents and that. There's an agency in the UK now that deals with them.
Yeah.
And that's made it easier, but it's also made it harder in the same context because
there's more middlemen to deal with.
There is. And I've not been a fan of agents, to be honest. Some of them don't respond. Some of them don't respond on time. Some of them are very rude. Some of them really try their luck.
Yeah.
Some of them are just full on demanding. And it's like, you know, I've only emailed you over over a few months, but I want to punch you in the face when I see you kind of thing.
Yeah.
And compare that to Japan. When we were looking at Fumiko, because we'd had Johnny Young Bosch, so we're like, oh, Ichigo's coming. Let's get the Japanese voice actress for Rukia. That'd be some great marketing. And we went to, through, this is our first time, because any time we book a voice actor or actress, it's been online. We Google them, we Google their agents, we get in contact with the agency, and the agent comes back with like either a rider, an offer, or asking for more details. With Japanese agents, they usually have a form online, but the form only extends to putting in details for what prefecture you're in.
Yeah.
And there's absolutely nothing for overseas. The geography for UK conventions is another thing that plays against us.
Yeah.
Because America, they have their dubs and they're fine. American conventions will thrive because they're right on the doorstep. Japan, same thing, their events, they're right on the doorstep. And even America, like Japanese voice actors going to America, you know, it's like a short flight. The UK, we're slap bang in the middle of nowhere between them. And where we have this reputation of like, yes, we're this historic cultural place, we used to rule the world once. It's not that case anymore, and costs are ridiculous. And
yeah,
that's just another thing. But back to the agents, like we contacted the agent, and it wasn't the agent directly. We contacted the company, and the company says, like, you know, would it be okay for us to Skype? And they had somebody who spoke English on this Skype, and basically she just wanted to meet me in person online, rather than just being like this cold email, like back and forth. And we spoke, it was only a short, like 20 minute conversation. And she introduced me to the actual agent, because each talent representative has their own kind of like agent slash handler. And he was amazingly polite. You know, when they say like they're overly polite, even if they can't see you on the phone, they're bowing and whatnot. Yeah. Same with Skype. It was really like, it was a fantastic new experience for me, because like with me, it's agents. It's just like, is X free or X is free? They want this much, me back. Well, we can afford this much. Is this good? Yes or no?
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. And then we sign a contract and we promote, and we do very little in the way of like talking to the guests with American voice actors. I mean, voice actors we've got at the moment. I have a direct email to Erica.
Yeah.
But Brittany, everything's going through this middle person.
Yeah.
And with the Japanese, they were, well, Fumiko was happy to come. I didn't speak to Fumiko directly, but the agent was there at every step of the way. And they were wanting to know things such as, do I need anything for a visa? Can we have a covering letter just in case? Is it possible to go on an excursion in London by any chance? And they were very thorough and organized. Thorough and organized. That's not to say the Americans aren't for and organized. It was just like every nook and cranny was explored.
Yeah.
With the Jerry. And when they arrived, it was very like formal, polite, hello, like, you know, we're excited. And take it with Quinton. When Quinton gets off the plane, he runs up and he just cuddles us, hugs us. He's like, hey guys, how have you been? And we're like, oh, we didn't know whether to shake your hand or not. And he's just giving us cuddles. With the Japanese, the more reserved, it's like, hello, business card. Bow, shake hands, thank you, welcome to the United Kingdom. They're all excited, taking everything in, drop them off at the hotel, and then they're given a schedule, and they follow that schedule to a T.
Yeah.
Any issues, any questions they have, they will ask straight away. Whereas with Americans, the more loose, the more free-going, it's like, well, here's your schedule. They'll not ask many questions, if any. And it's a difference in cultures there.
That's the thing. When you get right down to the voice actors, again, like I said, there's only so many questions you can ask the voice actors. What I would love to see UK conventions doing with regards to the actual voice acting is starting to broaden and move away from not just American voice actors, but starting to broaden their horizons and invite some directors over.
That's a difficult thing. That's a difficult... It's not as difficult, but the... You look at from a promotions point of view, you want something that will sell tickets, because most conventions, they run on potential ticket revenue.
Yeah.
And you need someone that will sell. Like for us, it's definitely the voice actors. The voice actors are the big thing. We've got people traveling from all over the country just for who we book.
Yeah, but my point is, if you got Watanabe here.
Yeah. But there's another thing, because the language barrier is still a thing.
The language barrier is still a thing. Yeah, I agree. The language barrier is still a thing. But if you got Shinichiro Watanabe,
yeah,
director of Cowboy Bebop, Samurai Champloo, the rest of them, yeah,
yeah.
If you got him at SunnyCon, his name pretty much eclipses just about every voice actor you could name.
Yeah. Oh no, we when we started, we wanted Akira Toriyama over.
Yeah,
and it was one of them things. Like I said, one, there's the language barrier, because when you're getting in touch with directors or you want a famous mangaka over, or somebody in the industry, really, rather than just voice actors, somebody in the industry, they're really busy. We have attempted to get more Japanese voice talent over, the more popular ones, shall we say, and they're busy. that's what we get. We get polite, you know, we're honored that you'd consider us, but unfortunately, they are busy for the time of your convention.
Yeah, my point is that there is so much more you could look at. This is the point I'm making. With America, it's limited to just voice actors. But when you look at the Japanese industry, you've got voice actors, you've got idols, you've got directors, you've got manga authors, you've got doujin circles, you've got toy makers, you've got game creators, you've got so many other options that are all related to anime and manga.
All a risk.
Possibly, yeah. It comes down to the risk versus the reward. This is one of the reasons why I think UK conventions are lacking, because it's very safe.
It is very safe.
I think that is the biggest problem, because when you go to something that is the same as everywhere else, then you don't feel the need to go.
Yeah. I mean, people grow up, they'll get jobs, they'll get responsibilities, and all of a sudden anime conventions, you know, we don't have that kind of retention because it's the same thing, just a different city. It's been one of my criticisms of some events. And it's been one of the things that I personally have tried to avoid. I want SunnyCon to be mirror. I want it to be a different SunnyCon every year. You come to one SunnyCon, it's not like the last. The only thing that stays the same is the venue and possibly like the stage layout. The rest of it, I want different panels, I want different guests, I want cosplay props, I want photo shoot areas. All these things that I want, though, cost a lot of money, and we have to gamble on if tickets will sell and if they'll sell in the volume when they do. And we've seen a change because more conventions, that it's getting a lot more competitive. It's not to say that we're not growing, we are. It's just that people are leaving it later and later and later to buy. And I think when we initially announce tickets, the VIP ones sell out, the premium ones go, and then we have this lull from August all the way till like mid-January to February, and then they start picking up.
Yeah.
And more people are deciding to go for one day rather than a weekend. And with more competition, especially in the local area, we're like, oh, you know, it's a bit risky. Brexit's on the horizon. I've discussed this. So we can't really turn around and make these risks and take them and say, well, why don't we get like another guest in, but make it like somebody who's like not going to sell tickets, but they're going to be very relevant and fun to have over.
This is where I'm saying that it might not be as much of a risk as you think. The reason why I'm saying it might not be as much of a risk is because when I talk about Japan and the people that you could have access to in Japan, who do you think I'm talking about?
Yeah, like you said, it's more the directors, the production staff, rather than the voice talent.
Do you think I'm focusing on just the big names?
Oh, no. There's the cogs, so to speak, that make it all work and come together.
See, here's the thing. You've read Bakuman, haven't you?
Yep.
It's an idea I actually got while I was reading Bakuman, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, hang on, I've read so many manga that were actually really good, but were cancelled early.
Yeah.
Read so many manga that were cancelled because maybe they weren't popular or anything like that. There are so many manga authors who literally aren't doing anything at the moment.
Yeah.
And if you offered them a trip to England, attend a convention, they'd probably jump at the chance.
Oh, that's...
If you look at doujin circles, who attend Comiket, and you got in touch with some of them and said, look, does one of you want to come over here and talk about what you do? Because they are the bread and butter. They are the foundation upon which all anime and manga is built.
Well, say that's... That's appealing to the niches, though.
Well, it's not really appealing to the niches. This is the thing. From my observations of the UK community in general, and I'm not talking just about the UK community that goes to conventions, I'm talking about the UK community in general. From what I can see, the UK community is starved of a lot of stuff. Literally starved. And part of the reason is because conventions are almost slavishly focused on this particular format, the safe format. And there is a desperate need for more, for something different. And one of those things that is different, I mean, when I stand in a comic book store or somewhere like that, or when I speak to people at conventions and I start talking about this particular manga creator or this particular manga that I've read, and people look at me going, where did you discover that? How do you know this stuff? Where did you find this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And the simple fact is, I know about this stuff because I have good connections within the community here in the UK and overseas. That comes from the work I did as a critic. But now, when I look at the UK community, we have all of this information, but people don't really know how to make sense of it. And if you go on to somewhere like My Anime List or AnnieDB or Anime Planet or something like that, you have so many people writing reviews of this or that or the other, but people don't really pay attention to it. They just look at what score you gave, and that's it.
Yeah, it's one of the things, because people, well, we've noticed the change is people want YouTube.
Yeah.
Having an opinion on YouTube gets you a guest status these days, which is something I'm not personally, like, you know, acclaimed with it, even though we have YouTubers. We have Toby the Birdkeeper. He's a big, like, he does theories on Pokemon, and a lot of people like him. We've had requests for other ones for people from YouTube asking us to be guests. And the main issue for us is it's the budget.
Let me put it this way. Do you know how many conventions I've been invited to over the last 8 or 9 years? How many conventions I've been invited to all over the world just because of My Anime List?
I can imagine practically most of them.
Yeah.
If not all.
But that then begs the question, why me? Why not somebody else?
Well, you're the number one rated, though.
Yeah. But it's not just because I'm the number one rated. It's because my approach to coverage is very different to a lot of people's. It's more about giving people the information they need so they can decide for themselves whether they're going to like something or not. It's, as I keep saying, don't take my word for it. Try it for yourself. You never know. You might like it. I might have hated it, but you might like it. Doesn't matter.
Our method's dead. Now it's all about memes.
Yeah, it's all about memes. The whole meme culture is part of the problem right now when it comes to conventions. That needs to be combated by convention organizers. They need to start looking at ways to change things, to move away from the safe format and start stamping their own identity, something that so that it's truly their convention, so that if somebody goes to Sunny, then they know that is a memory for them. It's unique. It's not going to be the same if they go to Ame or Kit or Scotland Loves Anime or wherever else. Sunny is that. That's it. That's it. Done. No one can replace that memory. Nothing can replace that memory. It was something truly unique for that.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? And I know that's what you're working towards as well. So I know that you're receptive to this, but I know so many other convention organizers, let's say, who aren't receptive to that.
From their point of view, I can see it's probably about budget. Like I say, some of them have limited tickets, so they have a set budget all the time. And when some of these conventions are not for profit. The structure for them is a bit weird, because I've always found, like, you know, if you're not for profit, then, you know, it's a hobby, but you're trying to make money out of a hobby.
Yeah,
If you're making money out of a hobby, it's a job.
Let me just clarify something. You know this already, but I want to clarify it for our listeners, right? When something is not for profit, that doesn't mean to say it can't make profit. Okay?
Yeah. That it just means that if there is profit, they have to get rid of it.
They have to get rid of it in some way. There were so many organizations that started off as not-for-profit, but grew and grew and grew. And the reason why they grew and got better and improved and advanced forward is because the profit that they made, they reinvested back into what they were doing. Now, you can run a convention and have it not-for-profit, and it could be an amazing success. You might actually be able to draw a wage from that as well. Right? Mm-hmm. And the reason why you might be able to do that is because the money that you're making, you're reinvesting back in. Maybe you go to a bigger venue. Maybe you get better guests. Maybe you you do live shows or whatever. Maybe you get actual musicians, martial artists, whatever. Get them in. Get them in again, Tucky, for Sonny. Get martial artists in. You had the taiko drummers. The taiko drummers were great.
Ah, taiko drummers are coming back for Newcastle and Liverpool. They've actually grown a bit as well.
Do you know? Do you know what I'd love to see on the main stage at Sonny this year, either Liverpool or Newcastle? What I'd love to see is, you know, the guy who was doing the demonstrations of the traditional of the koto and the zither.
The
shamisen and the koto. Right, I'd love to actually have a proper performance on the main stage.
I don't know if we're getting them back or not, but I'm assuming Donna will.
But an actual performance, a proper performance, turn all the other music off and just have a proper performance on the koto and the shamisen. I saw something on NHK World, and this really got me. And we'll come back to this topic on another show, maybe when Mark's back as well. But I just want to round it off with this. There's a show on NHK World called Blends. And I don't know if you've watched it, but it's a really interesting and actually quite a cool show. What they do, they get a bunch of musicians, some traditional Japanese musicians, some actual just normal rock or pop musicians, or some even Western classically trained musicians, and they put them together. I mean, there was a great one that I saw where you had two women using kotos and one woman with a traditional Japanese flute, but the music they were playing was Western music, really well-known and popular music from the West, as in songs from the West, and they were playing really well.
Yeah, it was like, one that I saw that doing Smooth Criminal.
Yeah, that's the one.
Aye.
Yeah, that's Blends. It's really good. It's because that and Jay Mello are two of my favourite shows on NHK World when it comes to music. In fact, they're two of my favourite music shows in general. And I think that is something that it fascinates me, and it's something that I'm really interested in. I think it's one of those things that would really separate a convention from the rest of the pack if you had traditional musicians regularly performing throughout the day, or just musicians performing throughout the day. It's one of the reasons why Hyper Japan, just to bring Hyper Japan back into the mix now, I did say we were going to bring it back in. It's one of the reasons why Hyper Japan, people might say it's gone downhill and stuff like that, but people still go.
Oh yeah, in the numbers as well.
Yeah. MCM is the same, because MCM has that kind of live act type thing going on.
And they'll have the budget for it as well.
Yeah, but the thing is, they might have the budget for it, but I organised two 12-hour rock concerts for the Meningitis Trust on zero budget. I had no budget and I organised them. And I didn't just do it once, I did it twice. All I'm saying is that having a budget is a great thing, but it's not always necessary. You can trade favours and stuff like that as well, especially when it comes to musicians.
Well, it's one of the things we always get asked for musicians. Well, musicians always ask, saying like, oh, we're coming over. I wanted Man on a Mission to play at Sonicom, but we can't coincide with like their UK tours, because they're doing mostly anime opening themes. And
yeah,
I think that'd be pretty awesome, but it's just getting the budget, because like five members, like five flights, return flights for Japan and back, and we'd have to sell tickets. I mean, we've financially taken a risk before on live acts, and it has cost us dearly.
I'm not talking about bringing them over from Japan.
No, we can have some homegrown as well. Staging costs and whatnot. That's a thing that gets in our way, but overall, I'm in agreement with there is a need for change in UK conventions, but it's not as cut and dry. It's a much more complex issue.
Oh, no, I do agree with you on that. It is a much more complex issue than, and it's not black and white at all. But I think if you start making gradual changes over time, and by gradual, I mean, maybe 1 year you'll have like some traditional Japanese musicians on stage. Maybe they're from the UK. That fella who you had doing the talk last year, maybe have him on stage this year doing a piece, you know, playing music for maybe an hour, you know, and then maybe next year he might do two sets over the course of 2 days. and then maybe the year after that, you'll have more musicians wanting to be involved.
Well, that's how it works, isn't it? People go back and give good reviews, and then that's why most of the voice actors in America actually ask us. It's kind of flattering, but it's also like, oh, we don't have the money to bring this all over at once.
Thing is, like I said, that also applies to bringing people over from Japan, because if you start approaching people who actually aren't doing anything at the moment, and the agents and the editors, they will know. They will know, because you don't need to go for the Akira Toriyamas or anyone like that first. You go for the people who are relatively unknown. Let's put it this way. Attack on Titan is a big thing now, yeah?
Yep.
How many years has Sonny Con been running?
8 years,
yeah?
I think we're going into our year. Hang on. 2012 is when we started, but Sonny Con was like conceived in 2010.
Yeah. If I'd said to you in 2012, bring this guy over, because he'd only been featured on NHK World up until that point.
Yeah.
Right? That was how I found out about Attack on Titan. And that was, I think, a year or two before the anime series. And if
was
somebody...
Imagination?
Yeah. And if somebody had brought... Rachel. The thing is, if somebody had brought him over to a UK convention before Attack on Titan exploded, and people met Hajime Isayama at a UK convention before it became the big thing, yeah?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's an event. And what I'm saying is, there are literally dozens of manga creators who aren't doing anything or are working on a series that may eventually become the next big thing.
Well, that's the thing, getting ahead of the curve. I mean, we've had it with voice actors. Christina V was relatively unknown when we had her in Sonny Con 2, and now she's pretty much in everything.
Why don't you see if you can get Fuse?
That's worth a try.
But you do know who Fuse is, don't you?
The name's familiar.
Fuse is the author of the light novel, That Time I Got Reincarnated as a Slime.
Ah, yeah, that's what
and
it's familiar.
Again, light novel authors. There are so many. Do you see it's what I mean? That's what I mean. When you look at America, it's just voice actors. When you look at Japan, there's so much more you could get. But I'm not saying that you need to get them straight away. It's something to work towards.
It's to work on, and it's like we say, like, we need to diversify panels, and the whole furore over, like, should we be paying for panels or not?
It depends on what you're doing. I mean, if you're running a panel at a convention, there's a very simple question you need to ask. You've got a free ticket for the entire weekend of a convention just for running one panel, which may run for an hour, yeah?
Yeah.
It's as we talked about before, Tucky. What's the minimum wage?
It's about £7 or let's say £7.50. Just
what's the national living wage?
Living wage is about £10 an hour.
Okay, so say you give them £20 for running a panel. If they want to be paid, you give them £20 for running an hour's panel. Fine, but they then have to pay for their ticket.
There was a panelist who went to HabanaCon and she finished the panel, and then at the feedback questioned why UK conventions don't pay the panelists. And for me, it's like, well, we will if it's discussed beforehand. There's also a lot of contractual obligations to bring it that, such as if you want paid for it, then you have to become, one, self-employed, two, you would have to declare your earnings.
Yeah.
And that £10 an hour living wage you're earning, you still need to pay tax on that if you qualify for tax. If not, fine. But there's a lot of loops, whereas we can turn around as conventions and say, we'll give you a free ticket worth to the value of, like, you know, free ticket or T-shirt, £40. Some other conventions, like £50 to £70. And, you know, you can come and have a weekend, and for an hour's work, you know, you can't really knock it. And it's always been this thing that people are like, well, you know, they just run a panel, happy to do so, they're happy to be there, they're happy to share their passion with their peers.
See, this is where, again, one of the problems lies. And I've been, again, saying this for a while, and we'll end it here, right? But it's that overweening sense of entitlement. That, I think, is a fundamental issue. And until that is addressed, until anime fans and the community in general actually understand that conventions are a business, right?
And that's the issue. All we have to make money off it.
Yeah, all conventions are a business. Doesn't matter whether it's grassroots or not. They run on money. And in order to make that money, they need to do certain things. They need to run panels, stuff like that. Now, if you want paying for it, as you said, that person needs to declare themselves as self-employed. You can't turn around and say, oh, but can you not just pay me, you know, cash in hand? No, because it has to come from your coffers. It has to be on your books that you've paid somebody.
Otherwise, it's self-assessment time. Oh, there's this going out and you've got no receipt. And it's like, oh, sorry. And there's me, like, fined and like...
Yeah, that is the biggest problem. Because of the overweening sense of entitlement that runs through a lot of people these days, especially the younger folk, they don't think about things like that. They just think, I'm entitled to this, so I should demand it. They don't think about the legal loopholes or anything like that. And I know I'm being harsh by saying this, right? But I've seen it far too many times from far too many people within the community.
Well, it's not so much the case of, like, you know, conventions, like you should be pleased that you're doing a panel for us, the great and mighty convention. It's a case of, if you bring it up beforehand, conventions will consider paying you, because we do pay panelists. We do that.
The thing is, I'm not blaming conventions for this.
No, right?
I'm not blaming panelists for this either. What I'm saying is it's the mentality, it's the zeitgeist of the moment, right? It's how people in general are thinking at the moment. And I'm saying that is very destructive thinking and it needs to change.
Right. It's just that in this example at HabanaCon, it was brought up after the fact. Yeah. And I'm sitting there as a convention organizer. HabanaCon's getting a lot of complaints about it. And this is at the closing ceremony, like the feedback panel. And like the questions raised, it's, you know, you're right to bring up the question, but as a convention organizer, I'd be like, you didn't discuss with us. You said you do said panel. We've gave you the spot. You've ran the panel. And now you're asking for money or asking to be compensated. This could have all been discussed privately beforehand. And that would have been fine rather than to try and like cause this kind of outrage after the fact.
That's the thing though. People who have an overweening sense of entitlement, they want to cause outrage because they believe that they believe in mob rule. They believe if they can get the public on their side, then mob rule will ensue and people will bow to mob rule. Unfortunately for them, that's not how life works. And sooner or later, every single person who thinks like that runs into somebody who's bigger, nastier, has much sharper teeth, and isn't afraid to take them head on and take them down.
Mm-hmm.
It happens to everybody. Pride always comes before a fall.
It's just a shame because like HabanaCon had good intentions with their organization, and for that kind of issue to arise and put them in a bad light.
Yeah, but the thing is,
I'm just sitting there thinking, well, it's not really professional to ask for a wage after like you've agreed to do the job, done the job, and not discussed a payment beforehand and just expect it afterwards.
Like I said, it's that sense of entitlement. I've done this. I deserve this. No, you don't. Again, it comes down to panelists and professionalism. If you want to be seen as a professional, then act like it.
I think I've just got me new behind the weeps subject to rant on about.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to leave that there. We will come back to this topic at some point because there is a lot more we could cover. But
I'm not done yet.
Yeah, we're nowhere near done yet. But anyway, we're going to leave that there. We're going to move on because we've got some stuff that we do need to talk about aside from that. But let us know what you think about UK conventions, what could be done to improve them if they do need improving. Let us know in the comments below. We do love hearing from you all. But anyway, moving on to... So what have you got for us, Tucky? What's first?
I'm getting the short one out of the way. Battle Girls.
Is this that Battle Girls time paradox or just Battle Girls? I can't remember.
Oh, no, this is just Battle Girls. I did Time Paradox a while back.
Is this that Battle Girl High School or whatever it is?
Yeah, it's basically, right, I can summarise it in this. This show is about a bunch of schoolgirls, magical girl trope, lots of brightly coloured things, fighting monsters. Use the term fighting monsters loosely because it focuses more on them as their personal life rather than fighting monsters. So it's like, oh, you're gonna get like this troop of girls, battle girls, battling monsters, and you get very little of that, and you get more of the, well, they're just being usual girls doing tropey things in anime. And I've got nothing good to say about it, to be honest. It's not that it's a bad thing. It's just that I've sat there for hours on end, marathoning this, and it's that bad. The plot is so thin. They relied on the beach episode in episode 3. So it's like, you know, you've got nothing after 2 episodes, so you go straight to the beach episode.
Do you know why the plot is thin? I can tell you exactly why.
Go on.
Because this is based on an action RPG.
There we go. I explained it. And the thing is, it starts, it's like, oh, we fight these Ironius monsters or whatever they say, and they go around and they battle them. There's absolutely no, like, reason. There's no context to give you. There's no backstory. It's just they're girls, they have magical changing outfits, and they fight these monsters. So we're attacking for whatever reason. Who cares? They're monsters. They're
not
girls.
Only is it an action RPG, it's a social network game. It's basically, imagine if somebody did Farmville, the anime.
Stop funding these things. Dear Japanese industry, if you are listening, and I know you are listening, stop funding crap.
The game might have been a lot of fun to play. I think we talked about this before, Tucky. It's one thing to watch a game. It's another thing to play a game.
Yeah. To be honest, I could have put a play feature on this and it still wouldn't have been any better. The thing is, I understand that anime is an advertising tool. Anime is basically a 12-episode advertisement for the manga, the light novel, whatever it is. Stop doing it for mobile games. Yeah, your mobile game's making a lot of money and you need a new way to advertise it. Anime series is based on smartphone games is not the thing to do. Stop doing it. Let them be games. Let games be games and just keep your fan base like that. If you want to advertise, spend it on, you know, your billboards, on your trains, your subways, spend it on internet adverts, you know, do it that way rather than spend like millions and millions of pounds, dollars, yen, whatever, on making a really subpar anime series. To be honest, like, it brings anime down with it. It's one of them things. It's so stupid. It makes everything else stupid just by being in the vicinity of it. And I've sat there with 12 episodes and my IQ's probably gone down about 50 points.
Shall we move on then?
Please.
Right. I'm going to move on to something that I first watched many, many years ago, back in the early 90s. Early to mid-90s, I think it was. And it was a, if I remember rightly, I think it was a 4-part unfinished OVA. And it was based on a series of books that were being published from 1986 to 2017 by Yoshiki Tanaka. Now, I was always a bit confused because I remember when the OVA first came out, and the OVA, the original OVA, was called The Heroic Legend of Arislan.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, over time, they dropped the I, and it's become The Heroic Legend of Arslan.
Yeah.
I'll admit, it wasn't great. Sorry, it was a 6-part OVA. Jesus. But that, I suppose that includes the 2 movies and the 4-part OVA. It wasn't great. It wasn't brilliant. And everybody was basically a bishy. Everyone was a bishonen in it. But this was the time when we didn't even know what bishonen were. It started coming out around 1991, 92, something like that. But now, spin on to 2015, and you have a new anime adaptation of a new manga adaptation of The Heroic Legend of Arslan. And guess who's doing the manga adaptation?
Go on.
Fresh off the back of Full Metal Alchemist, it's only Hiromu Arakawa.
Yeah.
Arakawa Hiromu doing The Heroic Legend of Arslan. And doing a really good job of it as well. Because all of the characters have her distinctive style, you know, the facial structure, everything like that, that you see a lot in Fullmetal Alchemist and any of her other works.
Yeah.
They all have that distinctive facial structure and stuff like that. But what you have is basically a historical fantasy. And by historical fantasy, I don't mean that all of a sudden there's magic everywhere and people are, you know, weaving spells and stuff like that. It's a historical fantasy in the way that Kingdom is a historical fantasy.
We all know how popular Kingdom is.
Aslan, as well, is also very, very popular. Now, I know the manga people didn't take to it as much as they did Fullmetal Alchemist, and the manga is still ongoing, if I remember rightly. But that doesn't mean to say that there's not a good story there. And there is. There is a good story there. See, the whole point of the heroic legend of Aslan is that it tells the story of a young prince of the kingdom of Pars. Mm-hmm. And it's set in the year 320. The synopsis here, under the rule of the belligerent King Andragoras III, the kingdom of Pars is at war with the neighbouring empire, Lusitania. Though different from his father in many aspects, Aslan, the young prince, sets out to prove his valour on the battlefield for the very first time. However, when the king is betrayed by one of his most trusted officials, the Parsian army is decimated and the capital city of Ecbatana is sieged. With the army in shambles and the Lusitanians out for his head, Aslan is forced to go on the run. With a respected general by his side, called Darion, Aslan soon sets off on a journey in search of allies that will help him take back his home. However, the enemies that the prince faces are far from limited to just those occupying his kingdom. Armies of other kingdoms stand ready to conquer Ecbatana. Moreover, the mastermind behind Lusitania's victory, an enigmatic man hiding behind a silver mask, poses a dangerous threat to Aslan and his company, as he possesses a secret that could jeopardize Aslan's right to succession. With the odds stacked against him, Aslan must find the strength and courage to overcome these obstacles and allies who will help him fight in the journey that will help prepare him for the day he becomes king.
Yeah, the underdog prince fighting for his birthright.
Basically, yeah. But that's where this actually kind of shines, because the character of Aslan, and I like how his character is depicted, he's very different to his dad in that he's led a very sheltered life, and so he's kind of innocent in certain ways, and so he's trying to understand the world and understand things that he's not familiar with. For example, the Lusitanian religion, which is basically Christianity. Aslan and his dad, basically, they're supposed to be like the Moors, supposed to be like Muslims type thing.
All right.
And this has a very kind of Muslim versus Christian vibe going on. It has a very Arab versus European vibe. But I'm not going to go into that. It's a very interesting story in terms of the historical fantasy aspect. And it reminded me of a book I read a while ago called The Lions of Al-Rasan, which, again, is a historical fantasy by an author called Guy Gabriel Kerr. Where Aslan actually works, number one, it uses cel-shaded animation in certain parts, especially for battle scenes where you have lots of soldiers in formation. Doesn't work quite as well as maybe it could have done. It's not as polished as maybe it could have been. It's not too bad in terms of the animation when it comes to the action scenes, in terms of the normal animation. But when it starts using the cel-shaded CG, it's just a little bit clunky. But that's down to the studios. I mean, it's done by Sanzigen and Leiden Films, so one of the two needs to brush up a little bit with it. It's directed by Noriyuki Abe, and he's fairly experienced. And there's nothing wrong with the direction. The voice acting is actually pretty good in the English dub. The Japanese dub is great. The English dub, you know, Avatar, The Legend of Aang, The Legend of Korra. At times, it's a bit like watching an episode of Aang or Korra in terms of the way that the voice actors are speaking.
Right.
And the reason for that is because the style of language that they've had to choose. See, this is supposed to be a historical fantasy. And so the style of language that they've had to choose has to be a bit more formal. They can't go, "Hey, buddy, how you doing?" They can't go, "Yo, G, how's it going?" They can't do anything like that. They have to say, "My king, we have news from the front." Do you see?
All right, yeah.
So they have to be a lot more formal with how they're doing things, because they're either soldiers or they're generals or they're royalty or something like that. And it's set in the year 320. So everybody is minding their manners a lot more, which might not appeal to some people. Some people might not like it. the English dub is, you know, you can listen to it and you can enjoy it. Like I said, it does remind me of Aang and Korra to a degree. But there is a slight stilting with the English dub as well, because it's obvious that some of the voice actors aren't used to really formal speech.
All right.
And it does show a little bit with some of the voice actors. Unless you know what you're listening for, unless you're familiar with that level of speaking, then you're probably not really going to notice it. I did because, well, I went to a posh university. Sue me. In terms of everything else, I mean, the audio effects are great. The sound of swords clashing and blood spilling and stuff like that. The Foley on this is really good. The music is suitably dramatic and they've gone for the traditional kind of classical style, but mixed it a little bit with some Arab or even some Spanish influences. The style of clothing and buildings, the style of the clothing in particular for the character designs, you see a very distinct difference between the Lusitanians, who are following the Christianish ideology, versus the so-called Arabs, I should say, and their more Middle Eastern clothing and stuff like that. You see it reflected in the clothing, the difference between the two people. You don't see it so much in terms of the facial structure and in terms of the skin tone, but it is still there in certain little ways of behaviours and stuff like that, which is interesting to see. It's not something that you would think of being animated, but at times you can see, for example, the way someone kneels in front of the king. Which knee do they use? That sort of thing.
Yeah. A lot of formality amongst it.
Yeah, more formality amongst it. In terms of the actual buildings, in terms of the environments, with Ekbatana, for example, there is a very Islamic Arab style to the buildings. There are minarets, there are the domes on top of the buildings and stuff like that. So you have a very Arabesque style to the architecture of the buildings. But that brings me back to the English dub. See, I pronounce it Ekbatana, because I think that the emphasis is on the T, Ekbatana. You know, the B and the T, they're very harsh in that, aren't they?
Yeah.
And so if you were going to pronounce it, you'd probably pronounce it Ekbatana, yeah?
Yeah.
For some reason, in the US dub, they pronounce it Ekbatana.
Oof.
Do you see what I mean? It's a slight difference in intonation. It's a slight difference in how you say it, but it can be a little bit jarring if you pronounce it differently.
Just sounds like trying to say egg batter.
Yeah. But again, not really that much of an issue. It's something that you can breeze past. I've kind of got lost in the production side of things, but I'm just going to go back to the story a little bit. The story is good for the most part. It starts off very, very well, but then it meanders a little bit. And the first season is like 25 episodes, but it meanders a little bit in the middle of the story. It doesn't get to the point. And then you have the second season, which is 8 episodes. Doesn't make sense to me why the second season is only 8 episodes, but it's only 8 episodes. And the story continues on. But from my perspective, a lot of that could have been trimmed down and told in one season of 26 episodes, right? You didn't need a second season. You could have just pulled it all together, one season, 26 episodes. And then, because the story is still ongoing, you could have continued on with another season of maybe 12 or maybe 24 episodes. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't need this middle season of 8 episodes. And the reason why I say that is because there is a lot of meandering after the first 6 episodes. That meandering, it serves in terms of exposition purposes, but it doesn't serve for any other purpose. And you have a narrator, so you don't really need to have those extra bits of exposition. You can just get the narrator to do it.
So it's like that one friend who decides, like, oh, let's take the scenic route, but it just takes longer and frustrates everyone.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. And I think that's the big problem with the Heroic Legend of Arslan, is that it has difficulty getting to the point. Now, I know that's ironic, me saying that, when I've had difficulty getting to the point, but I'm finally at the point. It is worth watching if you're a fan of Kingdom or shows like Kingdom. It's a bit of an odd duck in terms of historical fantasies, but it is definitely worth a watch if you want something a little bit different.
Sounds all right. I bought the PS4 Arslan game.
Yeah.
And I only bought because it was like a fiver in Argos.
Yeah. Thing is, so, it's not a bad show. It isn't a bad show at all. It's solid show. It's good. I wouldn't say it was just decent. I'd say it's an actual good show. There is a lot of story there. There is a lot of storytelling there. It's just it has some difficulty getting to the point.
Mm-hmm.
Back to you, Tucky.
Right. So this is Occultic 9. It's a kind of horror suspense. It's weird. Like I say, it's from the creator of Steins Gate. So, you know, there's a lot of complex science involved in it. And it's a lot of very similar themes throughout it.
Yeah.
Now, I got into this. I didn't know what to expect. But it starts off following this lad, Yuta Gammon. And like I say, this is a spoiler warning because I have to explain it. It's a really complex series.
Sorry, what was his name?
Yuta Gammon.
He's Gammon?
Yeah, Gammon. He voted leave as well. Unfortunate name, great meat. So he's like this neat, living in a place called Kitchy, Georgie. And he runs a blog online. And basically, he's a clickbait enthusiast. And that's all he wants. He wants people to read articles on the paranormal and the occult. And all he wants is just ad revenue. And it's kind of like, yeah, we all know like sites like that. And that's all he wants. All he wants is just like clickbait. But he gets into a situation where there's a scientist who's looking at the science between like the living world and the dead, like the spiritual plane. And he's murdered. And all of a sudden, they start bringing these characters in, and there's 9 of them, so Occultic 9. And it's a fascinating watch because you don't know what's coming next. And I'm sitting there watching it, and instantly, like, first episode has me hooked. This guy's like there, he's been in a murder, there's other characters, there's his assistant with the abnormally large breasts. You know, it's kind of fan service, but you put to one side because they actually develop her character in such a way, which is like a surprise near the end. There's the scientist's son who thinks like his father. He thinks rationally, he thinks scientific, but his dad was more leaning towards like the paranormal, like the unexplained. So he has this kind of conflict that, you know, he didn't get to say bye to his dad, and, you know, his dad was a bit foolish in his eyes, but there was all method to madness. There's a independent manga artist who can draw the future.
Yeah.
There's a fortune teller girl in a school who does like online streaming and fortune telling. She plays a part in it. There's one interesting character. There's this girl who does curses for a living. She curses people using black magic. And her backstory and the context given to her character is amazing. Because she's this girl, and when she was younger, she it was just her and our older brother, and she loved him sometimes in a like overly like uncomfortable way. But that's not really touched on much. It just adds a little bit narrative to it. Anyway, so she needed a kidney transplant, and during said kidney transplant, her brother died. She got the kidney okay, but because he died, she was stricken by grief and managed to steal the body from the morgue and take it back to their house, where she lived with her brother's corpse for a year. But to her, her brother was still alive and still living and still talking and interacting with her.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until like a year later where the authorities have like burst in and discovered her living with her brother's corpse. And she has to be like kind of snapped out of this whole fantasy that she's built around herself. I don't know if it's like a trauma, mental trauma or what have you, but she's, you know, she has noticed the stench or the fact that, you know, our brother's dead to her. He's always alive. So is it a ghost? Who knows? Anyway, so she's like kind of, this is like post that, and she does curses for a living using black magic because she's very interested in black magic. I think there's other characters. There's a detective. There's a teenage detective in it. And he's all like, you know, he's one of them like cocky detectives, kind of Columbo. Kind of like he already knows everything, but he likes to play with people. There's that. And there's another detective who's like got psychic powers of our own and she can like touch an object and see into the past. Anyway, so these characters, they're all really well drawn out. They're all, I mean, for 12 episodes, fitting that much character development in is amazing in itself.
Yeah.
But it's all around this one city, and there's a mass event where 256 people commit suicide, and they're all getting pulled out of the lake and whatnot. And it turns out that these kids, a few of these kids' names, they're on the deceased. So then it's like, oh, how can they be dead? Because obviously we're seeing them, they're walking around. And that's where the more sciencey, like spiritual side of it comes in, because it turns out they did die. However, there's a scientific explanation as to why they're still able to walk around and like interact with the real world. They can still text, they can still like write online. And it's this thing that stems from the theory. And the Sling Nicholas Tesla's name in there. Obviously it's not based on real science, it's more of a pseudoscience. But there's this theory that there are two different planes. There's the living plane and the plane of the dead. Because when we die, our brain's electrical signal like kind of dies out. But there's this theory that the electric signals in our brain manifest on another plane, another frequency, so to speak. And there's a lot of radio wavy kind of references in this.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this was apparently puff off by Nikola Tesla, and it turns out there's this shady big corporate conglomerate company with links to Tesla from like 1914, which has been like steadily over the years building up this kind of like, I don't know if it would be, well, it's hard to explain. The plan's all laid out. Like, I think episode 6, it's all explained, like in this whole like evil boardroom situation. And they explain that they've been building up this surplus of scandium.
Okay.
Which is this kind of, it's kind of a drug, a compound, which when a person dies, the scandium is able to give them an astral form. So apparently it's like a spirit on the spiritual plane is different to the frequency of the living plane. That's why it's hard to talk to the dead. It's hard to interact with somebody who's deceased, but their thoughts are an electronical signal, and the scandium is able to boost that astral form. So technically they can live forever if it wasn't for time existing.
Okay.
And so it turns out that this company's been behind the scenes in this one city looking for people who are compatible with scandium and secretly injecting them because they're like a medical conglomerate. So they've been doing like routine tests on people and giving them injections of immunizations and whatnot. And they've snuck some scandium in.
Is this all in the first episode?
This is like in the first two or three episodes.
All right. Okay. I was going to say, this is all a lot to take in.
Oh, wow. Like I say, it's hard to do it without spoiling it. But they have, like I say, there's this mass suicide event where 256 people, and apparently it's all triggered by this medical company going into phase one and using basically these 256 people as guinea pigs. And what they've basically done is they've ejected the thought, like basically ripped the soul out of you. And all these people who are dead still have their astral form, and they've managed to synchronize the dead frequency with the living frequency so they can exist on this plane. So that's why they can interact and use a phone, use a computer, but they still can't be seen. They're still kind of ghosts.
Okay, right.
But it takes a while for them to get into that. And this big conglomerate also, they've been doing this through a religion, like the guise of a religion as well. And
is it worth watching, though?
Oh, yes. My word, yes.
The reason I'm moving you away is because you're telling me a lot of the story, and if this is worth watching, then you don't want to tell me a lot of the story.
Yeah, well, all I'm saying is the character development is amazing. It has dark, it's gritty, it's horror. It makes references to things like a Kotori Bako, which is an old puzzle box. You know the child's puzzle boxes in Japan?
Yeah.
But said in legend that these old puzzle boxes, if they contained the parts of a child, like fingers and legs and arms of a child, then they would be able to curse. And the more dead children you've got in this box, the bigger the curse.
Yep.
And, you know, like elements like that, which are like, wow. I mean, I think it's grim. It's gritty. It's dark. There's a lot of murder in it. There's a lot of psychological, like, what the hell's going on? And it's mystery. Like I say, there's a detective in it. There's a lot of questions that need answering, answers that need questions. And it's a really good read. And I mean, I know it's pseudoscience, but it's
read.
On...
Read?
No, watch. read it as well. It was a light novel.
Yeah.
And a manga. But these 12 episodes, these are, you know, I've watched so much of like Battle Girls. I needed this. I needed Occultic Nine. This was right up my alley. The horror, the suspense, the dark, like murderous, like kind of thing. This is what I love in anime. This is a work of art. The voice acting was great. You can ignore any flaws, of which there are a few kind of continuity errors near the end.
Yeah.
But you don't question them because it's been a hell of a ride. It's fantastic. You know, you don't get off the end of a roller coaster going, oh, well, that second drop was a bit crap.
Yeah.
You know, you get off there and go, wow, what a ride.
That's the thing. If you like a show, you can forgive certain niggly little bits of it.
And like I say, there's very few of them. Very few. And this anime, you know, I found out that there's a video game of it, so I'm going to get that for the PS4. And the story... It's like I say, it's such a ride, such a twist and journey. I've only described like much of the detail of the first three episodes. There's so much more to it.
Yeah.
And it's nine interconnecting stories just weaving perfectly to create this amazing tapestry of art. And I can't recommend this any more highly. And thank God it exists, really.
Cool. So, on to the final bit then. Based on Battle Girl, High School. Any recommendations to go alongside that?
Anything. Anything to make you forget it. There's nothing that can complement that show. See, if you like your mobile games, then...
I actually thought of a show that might actually complement it.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Go on, then.
Do you remember Battle Athlete?
I do not.
It was a very odd show. A little bit fan service-y, I suppose. But it was basically about a girl who... They had, like, this competition between Earth, the Moon, Mars, that sort of thing. And these girls were trained athletes, and they took part in these sports competitions to maintain the freedom of Earth against these aliens. And it was a bit of an odd duck when you got right down to it.
Sounds like Keijo in space.
No, because what I say is a little bit fan service-y. Keijo is a lot fan service-y. This was, like, mid-90s. And Battle Girl High School just, for some reason, reminded me a little bit of Battle Athletes. I don't know why.
Is it just the battle in the title?
Well, no, it just... Battle Athletes didn't really have much of a point either.
It just existed for the sake of it.
Basically, yeah.
Somebody funded it, and what a waste.
I mean, Battle Girl High School is basically a magical girl show, so you could mention any magical girl anime.
Anything to make you forget it, really. I wouldn't recommend watching it. Anything or compliment it, because it's not worth watching.
Okay.
Watching paint dry for me would be the best compliment to it, because, you know, the paint, you've got more action and a thicker plot.
All right. What about Occultic Nine, then? Any recommendations to go alongside that? Because I thought one straight away.
I see Steins Gate straight off the bat. It's kind of like that jumping through time... Kind of like what's going on. You don't know what's going on. Things lead to other things.
I didn't even go down the Steins Gate route. I went down a completely different route to you. Because I figured someone's going to choose Steins Gate to go alongside this.
Well, it has to, though. Yeah. It's the same creator.
Do you know what actually makes more sense and what actually fits better than Steins Gate?
What?
There's one in particular, and by extension from that, another one. Bacano. Because you said there's like nine multiple storylines, right? And there's multiple protagonists, effectively. And Bacano is one of the few shows where you actually have exactly the same thing. You have multiple threads, multiple storylines, and multiple protagonists. All told, over 12 or 13 episodes. And by extension from Bacchanal, Durarara.
Definitely Durarara. Not so much like the third season, but definitely the first two were decent enough.
And also there's one other that I think, because of the religious aspect you chose for it, and the fact that it's got a bit of horror in there as well, Ghost Hound.
Mm-hmm. Basically, anything with like a paranormal.
Well, not really.
Tweak to it.
Not really. I think Ghost Hound in particular, because the religious aspect plays a big part in the latter stages of Ghost Hound.
Well, is the religion's not so much like a proper religion thing. It's more of like a,
but that's
a facade
thing
for a big corporation.
Yeah, but that's the thing. That's kind of the same as in Ghost Hound. The religious aspect is a facade for something else. Do you see?
Yeah, I would say a little bit like Death Note as well. A little bit. Not much, though.
Okay. Obviously, for Arslan, I'm going to suggest Kingdom first before anything else, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, if you're talking historical fantasy, then Kingdom is basically where you start. So Kingdom is a recommendation. But I think also something like Yona of the Dawn, I think works as well. I think that fits as well.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Altair Record of Battles. And I think finally, Guardian of the Sacred Spirit.
Would you not say Fate Stay Night, maybe?
No. Fate Stay Night is not a historical fantasy. Whereas the ones that I've suggested there, Altair Record of Battles, Guardian of the Sacred Spirit, Yona of the Dawn, and Kingdom, they are more historical fantasies than anything else. Do you see what I mean?
I'm thinking more of the fantasy side for that, not so much the history.
The thing is, I think the history side has to play the biggest part.
Oh.
Because the fantasy side is all well and good, but fantasies are a dime a dozen. Historical fantasies are a different thing. See, historical fantasies are those shows where they take a moment in history and they apply fantasy to that. Whereas a fantasy is just a fantasy. Fate Stay Night, Fate Zero, they're just fantasies, that's it.
It's okay.
So I'd suggest those. But anyway, and possibly Snow White with the red hair. I don't know. But anyway, that's it from us for this week. If you want to catch up with any of our other shows, you'll find them all on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, or the podcast provider of your choice, whichever one you're listening to us through. Leave us a rating, leave us a review. It does help us with exposure, it does help us improve. You can also find everything that we do on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, including our Patreon and our shop. So, until next week, I have been Rob.
And I've been Tuck.
And we will see you all later.
Goodbye.